Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. Shortly, we'll be hearing about two books that feature this week: Irish Shipping, A Fleet History, launched in the past week in Dublin, Cork and Rosslare, and the memoir of Pat O'Connell, the fishmonger. More on these in a moment. We have news of a talk on Raolt na Mara by Bill Nelson in Clontarf this Monday night, and radio officers are gathering in Hall Boland this weekend. First this week to the green fields of Belgium, on the lines of the Canadian poet John McCrae. In Flanders fields the poppies grow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. Kieran Devaney travelled recently to Flanders fields.
So this is the island of Island Peace Park. This park commemorates the just shy of 50,000 men from Ireland that died during the First World War.
I'm in Belgium near the small town of Ypres, seen as some of the bloodiest battles of the Great War. A round tower stands on a small hill here, overlooking the green fields of Flanders.
The park was opened in 1998, and it was opened by the three heads of state. It was opened by the Queen, it was opened by Mary McAleese, and by King Albert II of Belgium.
But one band of Irish volunteers remain largely forgotten, almost airbrushed out of history. The men of the Irish Merchant Marine, who signed up to join the Royal Navy, only to travel to England to find there were no ships. Instead, they were press-ganged into the British Army and sent to be slaughtered in the trenches as members of the Nelson Brigade of the Royal Naval Division. Back in Ireland, Patricia Gillen remembers, though, reminded perhaps by a faded newspaper cutting.
When the Sligo Champion reported his death with a photograph, a shrine was put up in the house, just inside the door, on a special shelf, and remained there until the house was demolished.
Michael Joseph Gillen was Patricia's uncle. And while the rest of us have forgotten, Michael Joseph lives on in her journal, which she keeps in a home in Drumcondra, in North Dublin.
Michael Joseph came from a maritime village in Sligo. The largest of the population were seamen, radio officers, captains of ships, bosuns, able seamen, and mostly merchant seamen.
But when he enlisted, did he think he was going to go to sea with the Royal Navy?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the sea were their lives. I mean, look at all those Ross's Point men. The sea was just, you know, their lives, and that's it.
But he ended up in the army.
Would you say the Royal Navy is the army? I really don't think so.
She still has the widow's penny, passed down through her family.
Well, that was given to the next of kin, and who was his mother, really. And you see what it says. He died for freedom and honour, with his name here, Michael Joseph Gillen. Nothing else. It's very heavy brass. I think it's something to be treasured.
While watching, I noticed a whitish blue mist to the northeast of us and behind the French lines. We soon noticed a peculiar smell which made our noses and throats tingle, but it was some time before we realised this was the much talked of gas.
I'm in the Flanders Field Museum in Ypres, where ghostly hologram figures bring to life the men who died from the mustard gas, which claimed the lives of so many of the Irish merchant seamen of the Nelson Brigade of the Royal Naval Division.
While the mad guns cursed overhead and tired men sigh, with mud for couch and floor, known that we fools, not that with the foolish dead, died not for flag, nor king, nor emperor, but for a dream, born in a herdsman's shed, and for the secret scripture of the poor.
No applause, no memory and poetry, no white marble tombstone in a green Flanders field for Michael Joseph Gillan. He was posted to Gallipoli in northern Turkey, where he died an almost equally horrific death at the age of 24.
From what I have read in all the details that we have here in front of us, I think he was an unidentified body. And we don't know, he could have been blown to bits.
Tonight, like every night, 365 nights a year, the old and the young gather here at the Menin Gate in Ypres to remember all the dead of the Great War. And at 8 o'clock precisely, the crowd quietens.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this daily act of remembrance. May we please ask to be silent and please do not applaud during or after the service. Thank you.
As the wreaths are laid and silent prayers are said, there's seldom a mention of the Irish merchant seamen of the Royal Naval Division. But as long as Patricia Gillan lives, Michael Joseph's name will also live on.
I was baptised Patricia Josephine, and whoever registered me had him in mind because they registered me Josephine Patricia.
Kieran Devaney on Flanders and the Forgotten Heroes of the Merchant Marine, with special thanks to Trevor Sweeney. Kieran's visit to Flanders was facilitated by Paths to Commemoration. The Rosslare Maritime Enthusiasts and Rosslare Maritime Museum have good cause to celebrate with the publication in the past week of the superb Irish Shipping A Fleet History. The authors are John Boyce, Brian Clear, Brian Boyce and Leo Coy. Prior to the launch, Seascape spoke with Brian Clear and Leo Coy. We hear first from Leo.
Yeah, we are. We're a crowd of maritime enthusiasts who got together in 2004 to commemorate the rescue of the Royal Concorde by the Rosslare Harbour lifeboat. And we did an exhibition in Rosslare Harbour in that year. And from then on, we did more exhibitions. We got to 2009, which happened to be 25 years after the demise of Irish Shipping Limited, and we decided we'd put on an exhibition in Rosslare Harbour to commemorate that. We then repeated that exhibition in Ringaskiddy in the National Maritime College, and they were both great successes, both exhibitions. And that sowed the seeds for a book. Now, Brian Clare has been collecting photographs and everything about Irish shipping for the last 10 years. And that was the foundation of a book, and it's taken us from 2009 to now to get it together.
Up until the start of the Second World War, Ireland didn't have a deep sea fleet. Limerick Steamship Company had some deep sea ships, but by 1939 they were all sold and gone. And with the onset of war, Ireland was depending on countries like Greece and France and Britain to supply the main foodstuffs, oil and everything else that was needed for the country. With the onset of the Second World War, these countries needed their own ships to supply their own needs. And as Ireland had declared neutral, Britain pulled out her ships from the Irish route and concentrated on their own needs, with the result that Ireland's food supplies and stock supplies were running desperately low. The Irish Shipping Company was formed. The directors of Palgrave Murphy, Limerick Steamship Company and the Wexford Steamship Company were called to a meeting in Dublin where Irish Shipping was formed, and their first and biggest task was the acquisition of ships. At the time, the only ships available were ships that were wrecks. They were well past the sell-by date and nobody else wanted them. For these wrecks, they paid a huge price because of the time of war. One of the ships was actually on its way to being scrapped in Hammond Lane in Dublin when Irish Shipping stepped in and purchased it. Another ship was found abandoned in the Bay of Biscay. She'd been attacked by German bombers She was the Vasilius Destunus. She was eventually towed into a Velis. The Irish Shipping Company sent over representatives. They port the ship, and I believe they paid something in the region of £80,000 for this wreck, absolute wreck. And they spent weeks and weeks trying to get her seaworthy. Eventually, they got her seaworthy, took her down to Lisbon, loaded a cargo of wheat, brought it to Dublin in October 1941. This was the Irish Poplar. And when she docked in Dublin to discharge that cargo of wheat, in the country, in the whole country, there was less than a week's supply of wheat. That's how close they came to starvation in Ireland.
Leo Coy again on the remarkable seafarers.
The sailors and the seamen on there were incredibly brave. I talked to a guy a few years ago, and he had done 15 transatlantic crossings in these derelict ships, not only putting up with the weather during the winter, but also the U-boats as well. Incredibly brave men, and the country is in their debt. They were so brave, and to keep going across again and again to keep this country supplied was incredible achievement. And the three companies, Palgrave Murphy, Limerick Steamship Company, and the Wexford Steamship Company, have got to be congratulated on their part they played in these shipping lines. The big surprise for me, being a Wexford man, is the involvement of Wexford, the Wexford connection, I call it. James Stafford played a major part, and John O'Neill played a major part in the company. Matt O'Neill was the master on the Irish Pine, which was lost with all hands. It was a U-boat got it out in the North Atlantic. And the very first ship, the Vasilius Destunus, Matt Moran of Wexford was the master on that. So a big Wexford connection to Irish shipping, and that's what I got hooked on. The whole thing is a great surprise. I mean, we've worked on it for years, but seeing it all put together is absolutely fantastic. Probably the biggest surprise is how renowned Irish shipping became in international terms. They were a very famous and a very well thought of shipping company. And all the countries they visited, they were very, very well received.
You know, it's a sad indictment that here we are surrounded by the sea, that we don't have our own fleet. And even today, although I do believe now Arklow Shipping are building some large bulkers now, so maybe we'll get some deep sea ships back into the Irish shipping scene. But you're asking about surprises. Remember, Leo, that fella in Cove? Yeah. We were doing a presentation in Cove one time for the gathering of the dockyard. And we were doing a presentation on the first 15 ships. And one of the ships we talked about was the Irish Plain, which was wrecked on the rocks at Ballyshane near Ballycotton in 1947. And after the presentation, a chap came up and just tapped us on the shoulder. And he says, "I remember that Irish Plane," he said. "I was a young lad," he said, "only a young fella," he said. "And when I heard about the shipwreck down in Ballycotton, I got on my bike and I cycled down to Ballycotton." And no, this was the middle of winter 1947, at the time of that really heavy snow, terrific storm had been blown. The ship was wrecked on the rocks. Anyway, he cycled down to Ballyshane, and he was standing on the cliff looking down at the wreck. And then he said, he got a tap on the shoulder, and a fella said to me, "Would you like to go on board?" And he said, as a young fella, he said, "I couldn't believe it." I said, "I thrilled a bit." It turned out it was the chief officer of the ship, a gentleman by the name of Caird. He became Captain Caird. And we went on board, and he took me around the ship, and he showed me around the ship. And the one abiding memory I have, he says, of that, he says, was looking down into the huge forward hold and seeing this huge big rock sticking up through the bottom of the ship. But anyway, we had a nice tour of the ship, and as I was leaving then, he said to me, "Would you like to take something home with you?" So he brought me down into the galley stores, he said, and he gave me a load of butter, rashers, bacon, sugar, and he says, I stuffed all I could into me jumper, and I cycled all the way home, he says, thrilled bits with his. And when I got it home, he says, "You wouldn't believe the trouble I had trying to convince me mother that I hadn't robbed the stuff." that was a man by the name of Ken Murphy. Unbelievable, terrific. Yeah.
We'll hear more from Brian Clear and Leo Coy on Seascapes next Friday night. Irish Shipping, A Fleet History, is available from Rosslare Maritime Enthusiasts and in select bookstores throughout the country. On Monday night, Clontarf Historical Society are hosting a talk by Bill Nelson on Raelt na Mara, the iconic statue on the Bull Wall. The talk takes place in the St John the Baptist Resource Centre in Clontarf at 8:15. The North Shannon Yacht Club, NSYC, has been revived by a group of yachting enthusiasts following a meeting held recently at which the club was reconstituted, officers selected, and the NSYC registered with the Irish Sailing Association. The new officer board members are Commodore Kevin Dunn, Vice Commodore Chevalier Joe Tiernan, and Rear Commodore Darren Louis. The revised club, like its predecessor, will base itself on Loch Bodergue and hopes to make the club as vibrant again as it once was by adopting, they say, an extensive range of activities, social as well as marine, including an annual regatta. You can read more about the club's history on the Seascapes webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/Seascapes. Next, here on Seascapes, to an historic photograph which led to a memoir being written by a man who is undoubtedly the best-known fishmonger on this island. Following that royal visit and the fact that monkfish is referred to in Cork as the mother-in-law fish, he is Pat O'Connell, and he told Seascapes about the early beginnings of a family business.
When I was very young, and being honest, I don't think I ever lined it up as a career once I started thinking about careers. But I was in the market from a very young age. And I suppose I was seeing sometimes the wrong side of it in the sense of long hours, cold mornings, freezing auctions. And I was probably thinking, yeah, there has to be a better way. People walk in at 9 o'clock and they see this fantastic array of fish on the counter, particularly in a place like the English market. And I'm sure some of them don't think, like, number one, where did it come from? You know, there was a bit of a wind last night or yesterday, you know, but sure. You know, we don't think about where it came from really a lot of the time. Or the poor guys that go out and catch it. Or you don't think of putting the ice up in the counters and putting up that display and, you know, making sure everything is ship-shape. And like, there's 2-3 hours working every morning in that. The business even to this day is very much based on what would have been mother's beliefs and mother's way of doing business. How did she get into it? God. They had a vegetable shop in George's Quay. And way back in those days, we'd be talking around 54, 53 probably. There were small little 12-foot boats who'd come up and tie up a George's Quay. They'd fish down by the castle for things like flounders and salmon, pollock, this kind of stuff. And they'd come up by George's Quay. So it kind of made sense in a lot of ways to be selling a bit of fish on a Friday, you know. And mother, not being one to miss an opportunity, probably looked at it that way as well and said, you know, sure, we'll do a bit of fish. So that's where the seeds of it started. But then when she got married, my granny didn't like my mammy's choice and daddy. And there was a little bit of a falling out. So mam went to work in the market in a fish stall as it just happened. But I think that was only pure chance rather than anything else. I think she just sold veg or meat as easy as fish. And it kind of took off from there, really. I did, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I was the worst student in the class by any means. I wasn't the best one either, but I mean, I mucked away and I did what I enjoyed. And I mean, some subjects I liked more than others, obviously. But I suppose in those days, I kind of saw myself going into somewhere along the teaching line. Thank God I didn't. I pity the poor students. As I got a bit older, I was kind of drawn towards the marketing end of business rather than the accountancy side of it, which I still wouldn't be great at. But I liked the PR end of it and I liked the marketing, and CIT, or the Regional Technical College, as it was called, had kind of just opened 2 or 3 years previous to doing my leaving cert. And they were kind of blazing a trail in business studies and that end of it and the marketing, and I thought, yeah, that would be nice and I'd like to go down that route. Which is strange, I suppose, in some ways, because I kind of had in my mind, didn't go on about, I didn't want to go to business because I'd seen enough of it at home. And, you know, every tea time or every weekend was talking about business. And, you know, sure, obviously some of it brushes off, even if you don't realise it. Like we, you know, at home would have been very much business focused, and mother would have been talking about next week's fish or last week's fish or, you know, who was in or could she get hold of this restaurant or, you know, and all went to her own business. And, you know, I suppose, even though I was probably trying to deny it to myself, business was starting to get a hold on me at that stage even. But I mean, at the time when there was talk of taking off Friday Fest and, you know, there was absolute panic in the fish trade. Oh my God, what are we going to do here? Like, you know, it's bad enough as it is, you know, that is only kind of, I mean, realistically in those days, Marcus, was 2 days a week, 2.5 days a week, you had business. The rest of the week was just twiddle your thumb time. And at the time, like, there was absolute panic. And I think mother, to her eternal credit, was one of the very few who reckoned, you know, I think it's going to be good. Every other business is a 5-day business or a 6-day business, and we're only a 2-day business. You know, there's nothing wrong with fish. People do like fish. But, like, it just had this perception and this image wrapped around it that you had to eat fish on a Friday and it had to be smoked haddock or it had to be whiting or it had to be mackerel. And, you know, you were terribly limited in the choice. Because, again, from a business point of view, you couldn't carry a big variety because you only had 2 days to move it. So you really had to move whatever you had in those 2 days. There was no point in having anything over on the Friday because on Saturday you weren't going to sell it anyway. When you're involved in the fish business, and I mean, I know people keep saying, you know, it goes back to 1974. And it does to a large degree because back around 1974, I think the fish industry, I think one or two guys started to realise, you know, we have huge potential on our coastline. And I suppose the fishing industry really was, adolescence would probably be complimenting it. It probably wasn't even at that stage. And yet the quotas that we have today are basically set on what we had back in 1974. And to anybody in the fish trade or fishing industry, that is hugely, hugely, hugely frustrating. Because if it was oil off our coast, you wouldn't be giving your European neighbours 50% of the quota or 60% of the quota. We have 20% of European waters. I think we have about 5% of the quota. That to me doesn't make sense. And I cannot for the love of me understand why that cannot be in some way renegotiated. Because I think at the time it was a very bad deal. I can understand at the time why, because agriculture was a much more powerful lobby. And I think agriculture did well out of that deal back in 74, but I think fishing is just paying such a huge, long price for that. And, you know, like every fisherman that goes to sea, there's an inherent danger because, you know, if you have an industrial accident on shore, it's bad enough. If you're out there at sea, you're in trouble. If you have a major accident at sea, you're in trouble. And as quotas get tighter and as fishing regulations get tighter, it's becoming more and more difficult for these lads to make a living. And yeah, it's frustrating if you're in the fishing industry. It's really frustrating because there is so much potential. There is so much possibility of jobs in West Cork, in Castletown Bear, in processing. You know, you look at other countries like Iceland and you see how they manage their fish stocks and how much jobs they have on shore for every job that they have at sea, and you think, like, this should be Ireland. Like, we should be doing this with the rest of Europe. We should be processing and we should be selling at a premium to the rest of Europe because the natural resource that we have off our coast is just hugely, hugely valuable. And it's been, to me, unfortunately, I must admit, wasted.
We'd have more from the fishmonger on next week's edition of Seascapes, and we have a handful of copies of the fishmonger, courtesy of the Liffey Press. If you can tell us the alternative name for monkfish that we mentioned earlier, answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTÉ Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or you can send your entry by email to seascapes@rte.ie. The Radio Officers Association have a presentation of talks on Marconi and the heritage of early transatlantic radio communication. It's being held this Saturday at 3 o'clock in Hall Bolan at the Naval Base in Cork Harbour. The talks are Cork during the American War of Independence, 1776 to 1783, and that'll be presented by naval historian Joe Varley. The making of BBC Coast with Irish Navy personnel on Marconi's radio station at Clifton, and that's presented by Frank McCurry and Tom Frawley. And finally, Heritage of Marconi and Alcock and Brown in Clifton, presented by Shane Joyce and Michael Gibbons. Next week, here on Seascapes, we'll have more on Irish shipping, a fleet history. Hugh Oram explains how valuable, exotic bananas travelled at one time in the captain's cabin. They were of such value. And how the McCann family in Dundalk became the leading importer of these fruits. Fishing quotas and difficult times for Irish fishermen. We'll be hearing the second instalment of our conversation with Pat O'Connell, author of The Fishmonger, and the winners of our competition. All that and much more here on Your Maritime Programme. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.